This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio with guest host Jane Brown.
If you have an appointment today at any of the University Health Network hospitals, you have likely been made to wait even longer than usual due to a system outage caused by the spring storm, as you heard there in Bob's news from the health minister, Sylvia Jones. Actually, Libby is caught up in this herself, as she has an appointment today at Princess Margaret Cancer Center. She was supposed to see her oncologist at 10:30. And as of her last email to me and Ziv, she was still waiting. Libby is fine, by the way. It's just a checkup. Speaking of cancer, the ability of artificial intelligence to detect tumor cells could be key to more accurate bone cancer prognoses. And in addition, too few people are being screened for colon cancer, but there is a new test that might help improve the rate.
Now, time for the medical record.
We are pleased to welcome our medical record panelists for discussions on these health and wellness topics, among others. Dr. Malcolm Moore is a medical oncologist at Princess Margaret Cancer Center. Dr. Fahad Razak is Canada Research Chair in Data-Informed Healthcare Improvement at the University of Toronto. And Dr. Jamie Spiegelman is an internal medicine and critical care physician at Humber River Hospital, an esteemed panel for sure. Hello to you all.
Hi.
Hi there.
Good to be with you.
Dr. Moore, I will start with you to get your take on what's happening today with the system outage. We've just learned that it is this stormy weather that has caused it at the UHN hospitals, including where you work, Princess Margaret.
So, as you can imagine, we are now in 2024 heavily reliant on these IT systems. So when they go down, it is a nightmare, honestly, because we can't access patient information, you can't book tests, you can't get reports. And so it creates a lot of problems for people like Libby who are visiting in the outpatient clinic. If she's coming down to get results of some tests, those tests won't be available. So there's a lot of after work. I would say that these things are not uncommon. And I think in many ways, it's fortunate that this one was caused by a power outage related to the bad weather, because probably the commonest cause these days is the system being hacked and held for ransom.
Right.
And we've had some quite horrendous ones, including one in southwestern Ontario, where even 2 months later, they haven't fully got back up. So, you know, this is something in modern healthcare that we have to deal with. This is a particularly bad one. It'll be very chaotic today and for the next few days as we try to catch up. But as I said, there is some experience with kind of mitigating factors in how you deal with this.
I guess, Dr. Razak, it is a little bit reassuring that the outage was caused by weather rather than a hack. But as Dr. Moore is explaining, there is really a ripple effect when something like this happens.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I don't work at UHN, but I think all of us would agree this is the most important health network in the country in terms of volume and capacity of what they do. And so when it has an issue like this, there's major ripple effects outwards. And, you know, I think to Malcolm's point, all of us, our minds first went to, and I saw it in the newspaper coverage of it, they quickly wanted to reassure it wasn't a cyber attack. I think that we should look at what happened, overnight and what happened to UHN as a bit of a freak accident. I mean, the wind was extraordinary downtown overnight, and really worry more about the other kind of attacks, which are increasingly frequent, unfortunately, which are the cyber attacks. Those are very, very serious. They have much longer consequence. You know, Malcolm mentioned the Southwestern Ontario attack. My uncle in Windsor, Ontario, is one of the people affected. Metastatic prostate cancer, couldn't be treated in Windsor, waited and waited and waited weeks and weeks and weeks. And eventually they had to ship him over to Hamilton to get treatment. And so these are major consequences. And those, unfortunately, are both the thorniest kinds of outages that are occurring now, but also we have to anticipate they're going to increase in frequency. So I think there's kind of a bigger investment question around how to protect our healthcare data infrastructure against those kind of attacks. So Today is really tragic. I hope they get up and running very quickly. I think it highlights a broader issue of susceptibility we should be worried about.
Right. And that's where I want to go now with Dr. Spiegelman. What does this say about our reliance on the digital network and how we should be better prepared for events like what's happened today?
Yeah, I mean, we're completely dependent, like Dr. Moore said, on the computer system for providing healthcare to our patients. We rely on it for documentation, for lab work, for registration, which is a problem I understand at UHN today. So it's a complete reliance on it. And from our experience here at Humber River Hospital, we actually did have a cyber attack, or commonly known as a code gray, a couple of years ago, where the computer system was down for 3 to 4 weeks, where we had to go back to the paper charting, and it was a disaster. No one knew what was happening. And the most common, actually, downtime that we have from our computer system is when our computer system is getting updated. Usually, they do this between like midnight and 8 a.m. when presumably there's not as much activity. But during that time, we prepare for a week before with getting all the paper charts, printing out all the patient's information. So it is such a headache when the computer does go down, whether it's intentional or not. We have to prepare for it. There has to be backup systems. And this is something that I think we have to think about as a system. When the computer does go down, like, what do we do? We're completely dependent on it. Mm-hmm. And what is that backup system? We have to define that a little better going forward, I think.
The hospitals affected today and maybe into the next couple of days, as Dr. Moore suggested, are Toronto General, Toronto Western, Princess Margaret Cancer Centre, and the Toronto Rehabilitation Institute. Dr. Moore, what is your staff saying to you about how messed up things are in your particular office with your patients?
Well, we... you know, it's like I said, we've had these before, and I mean, we work in a clinic setting in the hospital, and the challenge really is that, particularly at Princess Margaret, it's the largest ambulatory clinic facility in the country. So when people are impacted and there are delays, you're talking about not tens of people, not hundreds, but literally thousands of people a day going through the center. So, you know, if everything has to be done manually, people have to have, you know, requisitions for blood tests printed out and signed instead of done electronic. If all those things occur, then obviously people like Libby and everyone else who is there today is going to have to just wait very much longer than they normally would. And we all feel terrible about that. But, you know, as of now, which is 12 o'clock, we're still in a code gray situation.
Okay, and we will speak with Libby here right after we finish with our medical panel, just to get a firsthand experience about what today has been like at the Princess Margaret Cancer Center if you are a patient. Still with cancer, what do you all think about artificial intelligence playing a role in cancer diagnoses and specifically around the diagnosis of bone cancer? Dr. Moore, I'll stay with you to get your reaction first, since that is your area of specialty.
Yeah, so this is, there's going to be we've already talked about some of these kind of reports that are coming out. I think a very interesting one a couple of weeks ago was the one on mammography, where AI can detect early breast cancers, you know, and certainly add to what radiologists can do. And the more you can digitize these kind of parts of medicine where people are visually reviewing images, inevitably, as AI gets more sophisticated, it is going to be at the least an adjunct to our current situation. And the two specialties that are most impacted, I think, at the moment are radiology, reading x-rays. So there's no question AI is going to be part of that in the future. And the other one, is, and that's what's referred to in this one, is pathology, where pathologists look at a slide and kind of visually make determinations about what's a cancer cell, what's a dead cancer cell. Well, again, you can train AI machines to do that with a lower error rate. And again, there's no question whether they'll replace radiologists and pathologists to some degree, you can discuss, but there's no question that it's going to be an adjunct to having human review of the material. And this is just one of many examples that are starting to come out.
Yes, AI for good, right, instead of for bad. Dr. Razak, so how does this work, AI detecting cancer cells versus the traditional way?
Yeah, so this is the, Malcolm said, is it has proven to be the most promising area of AI deployment within the clinical systems currently. And basically what happens is you have an image file. So imagine a photograph, but extremely high resolution. It could be a, CT scan of the chest. So that has very detailed information about the structures in the chest, the organs, and the bones, or it could be a tumor that's been removed from the body. And you're looking at a microscope image of it now under very high resolution to try and see the cells. Now, the reason why AI is so effective in processing this specific kind of medical information is that everything you need to know about that patient is contained within that image. And if you can imagine what a computer can do, it can go pixel by pixel by pixel, looking for patterns and connections between the pixels, the color, the intensity. And it can detect patterns that really, at this point, it's clear that once they are well-trained, they can perform better on average in many circumstances than even a very well-trained radiologist. And so this kind of image processing, whether it's a radiology report, whether it's a pathology slide, is the area where I think AI clearly has shown its ability to, I would say, exceed what humans can do. I'll give you an example. One of the most promising areas of image processing with AI is looking at eye scans, which people with diabetes have. These are the retina scans we look at to see whether the diabetes has affected their blood vessel. Now, looking at these scans, a well-trained physician who's maybe had 5 years of additional training can look at evidence of diabetic disease. But what we've now found is that the AI algorithms can not only do that better than a human on average in most circumstances, they can also look at the pattern of the blood vessels and determine if the patient is male or female. Now, that's the kind of thing that we cannot detect with the human eye, but it reveals the fact that the AI algorithms can pick up things that are well beyond human capacity to detect. And so, as Malcolm said, this is just the starting point. And I would say probably within 5 or 10 years, the question is not going to be if these algorithms are used. The question is going to be, how is the ideal medical model merge the use of these algorithms and human capacity in a way that is protected against errors as well? We don't have a good framework from a liability perspective right now to determine what happens, for example, if an algorithm makes a mistake. We know what to do if a radiologist makes a mistake, but we don't know what to do if an algorithm makes a mistake and you rely on that algorithm. So there's a lot of uncertainty in terms of the specifics, nuts and bolts of how to integrate these algorithms into practice.
And I know you were having this conversation, not specific to bone cancer diagnoses, but AI in general playing a role in medicine a couple of weeks ago. Dr. Spiegelman, what are your thoughts on the era that we are approaching and the excitement that I'm sure it's creating in the medical community?
I mean, the goal of AI or anything that we introduce on top of what we are doing now is to make sure that our healthcare is better, getting better and not worse. So the goal is to make sure that we use it in a way that it improves patient care. And we've started using it in the early stages at our hospital in terms of radiology, for example. Our x-rays are AI generated now, but they have to be confirmed by the radiologist. So, for example, if you have air around the lungs, it actually shows that on our AI imaging, and we have to be confirm it. If there's a mass there, it also confirms it. So we have to confirm it with the human touch afterwards as well. So and that's not the only thing we use AI for. And I don't like completely using that word AI because everything computer generated is considered AI. It's a hot word to use right now, but really it's just computer helping humans do things. Yes. And what we have too is on our medical system, for example, for we're working up somebody for cancer or for heart failure or for a stroke, our computer system actually suggests things that we may have missed in terms of management or tests. So it's really integrated already in our system. It's just going to get better, I think, as we use it and adapt to it. There's always going to be a human touch to medicine. I don't think that's ever going to go away, whether it's in radiology, which is the field that it's most talked about, but also in everything else, in diagnosis and even in family practice where, you know, patient could put in their symptoms and the computer might say something. But I think you need that human interaction, that social interaction with the patient to actually see what's happening, to get the patient's reaction to really get a diagnosis and a management plan. So I don't think humans are going away when it comes to this, but yeah. I think this will be a supplement to our care that we provide our patients.
Right, exactly. I enjoy that analysis of what is happening. It is our medical record panel, Jane for Libby. And as always, the phone lines are open if you would like to comment or ask a question of our doctors, 416-360-0740, 1-866-744-740. Remember, the radio is anonymous. And I point that out because I want to know if you have put off getting a colonoscopy, if you're over 50 and you have yet to get one in your life, why? That's our next topic here with the medical record panel, 416-360-0740, 1-866-744-740. And we bring that up because there is a new blood test which might soon offer a more convenient way for people to get tested for colon cancer. Dr. Malcolm Moore, how does this work and what is its efficacy in relation, say, to a colonoscopy?
Yeah, so this is actually super interesting. This is not going to replace colonoscopy or the other method for colon cancer screening yet. But the whole idea of this is very sort of space age, if you like, is that tumors, we develop a cancer because we develop mutations in our normal cells that then become cancerous. And these mutations are in the DNA, and it's been discovered that small fragments of these mutations are actually circulating in the blood, even at the very early stages of cancer.
Wow.
And now the technology to actually look at this exists. And so what this particular test does is it looks at the 83 most common mutations in colon cancer and then tests for fragments of those mutations in the blood of patients who, don't have cancer or are not aware that they have cancer. And what they've discovered is that I think in about 85% of the cases, these people who had cancers that were only detected on colonoscopy also had blood tests which indicated the presence of cancer.
Amazing.
And so,
yeah.
And you can imagine that now for colon cancer, the gold standard remains the colonoscopy because it can also take out precancerous lesions like polyps. But as you can imagine, as we move forward, these tests are being looked at in other types of cancer. So you could imagine that as these tests become more precise, they could become screening tests for many different types of cancer that you could just do from blood. I'll just finish with saying that the big challenge with this, of course, is that if you get a positive result on one of these tests, it may be then difficult to actually find the cancer because, in many cases, these cancers at this stage are essentially undetectable by standard radiology. But this is the dawning of a new age in cancer screening for sure.
Oh, sounds like it. That is Dr. Malcolm Moore at the Princess Margaret Cancer Center. Dr. Fahad Razak is with us, as is Dr. Jamie Spiegelman, our medical record panel. I want to go to the phones now. We'll go to Rudy, actually, in Toronto first, and then we'll get to Judy. Rudy, go ahead with your question or comment.
Yeah, I'm actually calling for a friend of mine because this is coincidentally because she just recently went for a colonoscopy and they couldn't do it because she couldn't digest all the fluid that they had her to drink before that, as they said there was still stuff in her bowels.
Oh, okay.
So I'm wondering if there is a way that she can get a colonoscopy or there's a clinic that can do it without her having to drink that fluid.
Oh, yeah, that's just the way it is, isn't it, Dr. Moore?
I mean, that actually speaks to your first comment, which is that a lot of people do not go through screening for colonoscopy because the prep is honestly a pain in the ass, if you excuse the pun. It's very difficult and uncomfortable. But unless you can clean out the colon, and that's what the preps are forced to do, then if there's still stool in the colon, then the person doing the colonoscopy really can't visualize small cancers. So it's an inevitable part of the colonoscopy sequence and is the reason why people are looking at other ways of screening.
I like that. The colonoscopy is a pain in the ass. I'll remember that for always going forward. Judy in Toronto, you have a question or a comment?
Hi there.
Yep, go ahead. Great, you're on the air.
Okay, I just wanted to give everybody a heads up. I was supposed to have a doctor's appointment today, and I have mobility issues, so I canceled it. And she said, well, I'm glad you canceled it because our system's been down since last night, and that's nowhere near the U810. So I just want to give a heads up to your listeners to call and check.
Oh, okay, and which hospital, where were you going, Judy?
I was going to clinic at Main and Danforth.
At Main and Danforth, so okay.
Yeah, so their system's been down since last night.
Okay, well, thank you for that. Dr. Razak, does that sound like an isolated situation or related, or is it tough to know?
Yeah, tough to know for me. Obviously, the winds were extraordinary last night.
Yeah.
So if other institutions, parts of the city are affected, I wouldn't be surprised, but the specifics about where else unclear to me. The news reports I've seen have really honed in on UHN as
totally.
Kind of the major issue, but yeah, uncertain.
And I do want to get to a topic specific to Dr. Razak because you brought this to our attention. And we learned earlier today as well that Queen's University has announced a new lottery system in its medical student selection process with the idea that admissions will be more open to candidates from diverse and low income backgrounds. And I did not realize, Dr. Razak, that so many people applied to the Queen's Medical School, something like 5,000 a year. And 115 get chosen?
Yeah, I thought this was a really important step by Dr. Jane Philpott. So she's the dean of the School of Medicine at Queen's, now our former federal health minister. And the admission rate, so as you said, roughly 100 candidates admitted for 5,000 applicants. That's the story of admission to Canadian medical schools in general in this country. I mean, it's an extraordinarily competitive process. And the headlines, and there's been a lot of coverage of this change in their policy, said lottery process to get into medical school. And it gives, I think, a bit of a false impression about what's happening. So this is not just an open lottery where anyone can throw their name in. That would be a problem, of course.
Mm-hmm.
I think all of us who work in medicine, the students coming through, we're constantly impressed by how qualified they are. They're incredibly qualified. The issue here is that when you apply to medical school, not only do you have to have excellent grades, all of our applicants generally have excellent grades, but a lot of the extracurricular stuff becomes part of the assessment process. So did you volunteer? And a lot of us are kind of, we look at the students who are applying now, it's like you were digging ditches in Africa and you were also working at a soup kitchen and you were also, there's this extensive volunteering or research experience since they started sometime in high school. That is unfortunately not accessible to everybody. And we know this. We know that if you're from, let's say, a lower income family, the chance that you could have your summer off to go to Africa to volunteer or that you could work in a soup kitchen instead of getting a job that pays you an income is low, right? You probably have to work and pay your way through university. And what happens over time is you systematically then discriminate against, for example, lower income families. The students, even though their students are excellent from their test scores, because they don't have these other things on their CV, they become less likely to get into medical school. And I think the idea here is really novel, and it's been done in Europe already, I should say. This is not them trying it for the first time. It's that they first set a threshold to say, you must meet academic excellence. You have to meet the excellence of that bar. But once you meet that threshold, we then will do a lottery among all people who are above that level of excellence to try and decrease the discrimination against lower income families or students who are from whose parents have lower education levels. And we know that if you look at the typical medical student in Canada, they don't represent the population. So, for example, the typical medical student in Canada, they're half as likely to be from a rural setting as from an urban setting. They're five times more likely to have a parent in the highest bracket of income than the general population. So we know that we're drawing in students who are really not representative of the general population. And this approach is trying to equalize that admission process. And I think it's really important what they're trying to do.
Dr. Spiegelman, we're just about out of time, but I want to hear from you one more time. What do you think about this lottery system? Should it be the standard for medical schools across the country to give people more of an opportunity based on what Dr. Razak was saying?
There's definitely some truth to what he was saying. However, I think if you ask 100 doctors their opinion, I think you'll get 100 different opinions related to this. I think it's important to focus on merit to make sure that these people who get into medical school have the high standard. There should be equal opportunity no matter where you're coming from, which I totally agree with this system, but I don't think it should be random. I think if you work hard and if there, you know, you build up, you want to become a doctor, you should have the best opportunity to become a doctor, not just based on your skin color or your socioeconomic status. I think no matter what, you should have that opportunity. So I think we'll learn a lot from this Queen's process. I don't think it should be universally adapted quite yet. I think the same process has actually rejected in the U.S. about 5 or 10 years ago. So we have to learn from the Queen's process. We have to make sure that entrance into medical school is equitable to everyone and the best candidate should get in.
We will leave it there. I thank you all for your time. Libby will chat with you again next Wednesday. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Jamie Spiegelman, internal medicine and critical care physician at Humber River Hospital. Dr. Fahad Razak, Canada Research Chair in Data-Informed Healthcare Improvement at the University of Toronto. And Dr. Malcolm Moore, medical oncologist at Princess Margaret Cancer Centre, where Libby also is today. And we will chat with her about the outage, the system outage at Princess Margaret, coming up right after these.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio with guest host Jane Brown.
Libby will be back to host Fight Back tomorrow, but right now she is on the line with us because she has been at the Princess Margaret Cancer Center this morning where they have a big system outage as part of the University Health Network. Hospitals all enduring the system outage today, including Toronto General, Toronto Western, and the Toronto Rehabilitation Institute. Hi, Libby.
Hi, Jane.
So talk to us about your experience today at Princess Margaret.
Well, by the time we left, the system that the healthcare workers and the doctors used was still down. The patient portal was up. There were announcements saying there would be delays. I'm not even sure that the delay was much more than usual because when you go see your oncologist, there can be a delay. But we saw her. The problems are, I asked what happens if they're in the middle of surgery and they need to pull something up on the computer. And they do have some backup, but the worry is that it's not enough. Also, my oncologist was worried she's got patients who need chemo tomorrow, and all the orders have to be written on paper. And not everybody knows how to do that. She knows how to do that, but it's obviously more time-consuming. And also, the young woman who checked me in, I mean, she looked like she wasn't even born when they got rid of doing things on paper. So everything, I guess, is slowed down. And I don't know, have you heard any information about what caused this?
Yes, we were reporting at noon based on what Health Minister Sylvia Jones told a news conference this morning, unrelated, that it was the big storm. It was the spring storm and the winds that caused the outage.
Wow.
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
It is amazing, and it is pretty nasty out here. I'm actually in the car. We just finished our appointment, but I really hope that nobody's critical treatments are affected by this.
Yeah.
You know, for me, it was, you know, no big deal. I took the day off because I had this appointment, but it was a follow-up. All good.
Oh, good. Well, that's the most important part. And so you've gone through the system fairly quickly, given the situation there at Princess Margaret.
Well, I wouldn't say fairly quickly, but quick enough. Quick enough.
Okay, well, enjoy the rest of the day, and I'll talk to you tomorrow morning.
Okay, thanks, Jane. Talk soon. Bye.
Bye-bye now. Libby Znaimer, host of this program, A Fight Back with Libby Znaimer. Moving right along now, everyone is talking about auto theft, especially if your insurance rates have gone up because you drive a car that is on the list of most stolen vehicles. I actually fall into that category, as do many others. My insurance premiums, I just found out, are going up $50 a month from $127 to $177. And of course, you are talking about auto theft if you actually have had your vehicle stolen, possibly from your own driveway. Some people in Toronto are not waiting for it to happen and have hired private security to make sure their vehicles are not stolen. That's where Tom Doyle comes in. He is the Chief Operating Officer and Senior Vice President of Corporate Protection and Investigative Services, which provides security for those who want to pay for it. Tom, welcome to you.
Good afternoon.
And we will get to you in just a moment. But first, we are joined by Detective Inspector Scott Wade and of the OPP Organized Crime Enforcement Bureau. Inspector Wade is involved in Project Vector, the results of which were released this morning. They've recovered nearly 600 stolen vehicles. These vehicles were retrieved in a joint crackdown with authorities in Quebec and the Canada Border Services Agency. Collectively, the cars stolen amount to a whopping value of $34.5 million. So, Detective Inspector Scott Wade, tell us how this recovery went down.
Yeah, thanks very much for having me on your show today, and I appreciate the opportunity to share you the results. I can say it's a completely collaborative effort. Couldn't be done by any police service or any agency alone. So our GTA Police Services from the Greater Toronto Area wanted to show our support for our Quebec partners and our federal partners in law enforcement to increase the identification and seizure of stolen vehicles before they can be exported out of the Port of Montreal.
Okay. In terms of who took the vehicles, do you have any information on that?
Well, we specifically target the organized crime groups that are responsible for this. You know, we need to move upstream with our investigations and make sure we're interdicting them at the right point. So organized crime is responsible for the increase in auto theft, and that's where we want to focus. So with this project that we've done at the Port of Montreal with our partners, mm-hmm. we've taken $34.5 million out of the pockets of organized crime groups. So that's where our focus is, and that's who's responsible for the surge in auto theft.
And sorry if this question doesn't make sense, but will these vehicles be returned to their owners?
Yes, in every case, the vehicles recovered will be returned to the owners. However, at this point, depending on how long they've been, you know, stolen or they could be the property of the insurance companies. So in some cases, people are getting their vehicles back, but in some cases, they've already been paid out by insurance companies. So then, therefore, the insurance companies will try to recoup some of their losses.
Detective Inspector, this what has happened here with Project Vector is very unusual until now, isn't it?
Yeah, well, yes and no. I'd like to say that, you know, we have a long history of cooperating and collaborating with our partners, whether it's, you know, provincially, interprovincially, or internationally. However, this was something unique because we saw a large percentage of the vehicles being seized at the Port of Montreal were from the Greater Toronto Area. So therefore, we wanted a collaborative approach, and that's why we formed this partnership. And we're not done. Mm-hmm. We are going to continue. We're going to double down our efforts, and we'll continue to make seizures and continue the investigations.
Yes, congratulations.
No, thank you.
So how important is today and the results of Project Vector in moving forward in retrieving more vehicles than in having vehicles that are never recovered?
Sorry, I think I'm not sure if I understood your question, but what's important is that number one, removing the money from organized crime, mm-hmm. But also getting these vehicles back, so they're not transported overseas. Maybe if you could repeat the question.
I'm just wondering, will the results of Project Vector or results like the results of Project Vector become more common now that you've made this big recovery?
Oh, thank you. Yeah, and I do want to comment, and I think it's probably important to recognize that this is just one part of our whole of society approach to combat auto theft. So I think you'll see lots of efforts like Vector, Project Volcano, and other collaborative investigations having success.
No, it is encouraging, absolutely. And by the way, if you want to get in on the conversation, if you've had a vehicle stolen, if you've taken extra steps to protect your vehicle, we'd like to hear from you. 416-360-0740, 1-866-740-4740. And on that note, back to Tom Doyle. Tom, tell us about your company and what your employees do to provide security.
Okay, we started about 6 months ago when we really started seeing things getting bad. We were getting calls from different areas. They were asking us to come meet, such as the Bridle Path, Forest Hill, Rosedale, Woodbridge, and some other areas of Toronto. They were asking us to come meet them. We sat down and met with these certain people, and they were telling us they were having the problems of cars getting stolen, houses getting broken into. Mm-hmm. So what we do is we do a couple different things. If they go away on holidays, we'll have somebody sit in the driveway, 7 days a week until they're back, from maybe 11 p.m. till 7 in the morning, watching the house. If we see anything going on, we're not police, so we're not going out there to arrest the people. Well, we see anything suspicious, we take down license plates, descriptions, we call the police. If we see anything happening, the same thing. We can't make the arrest. We have to just call the police.
So your guys are basically just a deterrent.
Just a deterrent. And we've had things where we've driven onto the street. We've seen people take off. So we know what's happening. It's deterring these people. So,
And Tom, are your vehicles marked as security vehicles?
Yes. We have marked cars as security on it, corporate protection. And as soon as they see us coming, we've seen cars drive away, people jump in the cars and take off. So
it works.
So it is working.
Yeah. And how expensive is it?
So if you just want drive-bys, we can do drive-bys. It's $50 a drive-by. So if your house and you just want us to drive by a couple times a night, it'll cost you $50 every drive-by. Or it can go $65, $75 to have somebody sit there all night and watch your house.
Okay, and so are you seeing your clients? Are they living in luxury homes? Are they regular people? I mean, that can add up. But if you're going away on vacation for a week, it might not be a bad investment either.
So yeah, so like I said, we have I've had somebody from Jane and Finch calling us. They have a nice car and they were going away, so we watch their house. We'll pick up the newspaper, take their mail, even shovel their driveway to make it like people are home. So we do extra little things just to show that people are home, they're not away. Mm-hmm. Turn on the lights and things like that, different times of the day. They're paying for all that. So
let me go over to, and I want to get to the phones as well. I know you want to get in and talk about this, 416-360-0740. Detective Inspector Scott Wade from the OPP, what do you think about this as a stopgap solution for people who may be vacationing and can afford to bring in a company like Tom's?
Yeah, I think it's whatever people are able to do and willing to do to improve the situation is a good idea. And there's lots of other things that people can do outside of private security. We have a website. It's opp.ca/autotheft. And that will provide a lot of ideas and, things that people can do to improve the security in addition to a layered approach.
Let's go to the phones. Rocky in Etobicoke, what would you like to add? You're on the air.
Yeah, how you doing? Listen, I got a car, and I modified my gas pedal. So what I did, I take the gas pedal off. So you got no gas pedal, right? So if they want to steal my car, they ain't going to go nowhere.
Oh, okay.
So what I do at night, I take it off. And in the morning when I go to work, I just snap it back on.
Oh, what do you think about that, Detective Inspector? Is that among the suggestions on your webpage?
You know what? I mean, if Rocky's doing it and it's safe to do, you know, that's great. I wouldn't suggest that an average person removes their gas pedal or brake pedal just because I don't know enough about the mechanics of a car to suggest that that's a safe thing to do. But if, you know, if people are taking efforts, and some people remove the batteries, some people, you know, take mechanical steps like that. So my just suggestion is whatever you do, be careful and be safe. So removing a pedal, whether it's gas or brake, as long as you know what you're doing,
yeah,
you know, you're on your own. But that would be my concern with that.
Tom Doyle, final comments, over to you.
I just say, you know, if you have expensive cars, lock them up in your garage. Don't leave them outside. I've seen driving around, I see cars, you know, expensive cars, they're just sitting out in the driveway and you're just getting your target. So lock them up in your garage. Yeah. And just do what you can to, so they can't get to them.
And by Googling you, we can get all your contact information. Yes.
Yes, you can.
Okay. Tom Doyle, thank you very much for your time as well. Detective Inspector Wade, appreciate you coming on with us as well.
Thanks, Jane.
Bye.
Tom Doyle is the Chief Operating Officer, Senior Vice President of Corporate Protection and Investigative Services. Corporate Protection and Investigative Services, if you want to look that up. You can also listen to the podcast later at zoomerradio.ca. And Detective Inspector Scott Wade with the OPP Organized Crime Enforcement Bureau. Jane for Libby here, and still to come on today's Fight Back. If you're an empty nester, is now the right time to downsize your home to maximize profits? We discuss with two real estate experts next.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio with guest host Jane Brown.
Is now the right time to sell your home if you're thinking of downsizing, or if you have already downsized in this hot real estate market in recent years? We'd like to hear from you. 416-360-0740. Toll free 1-866-744-740. Brand new report out this morning from the Toronto Regional Real Estate Board says there was enough competition among buyers that the average home price rose moderately here in the GTA from March of last year to March of this year to just over $1.12 million. Overall, sales were down 4.5% year over year. Joining us to discuss, Karen Yolevsky, Chief Operating Officer at Royal LePage Real Estate Services, and Jason Mercer, Chief Market Analyst and Director of the Toronto Regional Real Estate Board. Karen, Jason, thank you for joining us.
Pleasure.
Jason,
thank you.
We'll start with you first, Jason, by offering us more of what was in this latest report. So the price year over year up slightly, but sales down year over year.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at what we've seen through the first quarter of 2024, has been a modest improvement, I think, in market conditions in the Greater Toronto area. And certainly if you look forward into the second half of 2024 with the expectation that interest rates are going to trend lower, you know, we should expect to see more competition between buyers, and that'll exert further upward pressure on home prices as we move through the end of this year and even more so into 2025.
What were your thoughts when you got the results from the March, the year-over-year report from March? Surprised that prices are up? Surprised that they're not up a little bit more? What are your thoughts?
No, I mean, when we had done our forecast at the end of last year and beginning of 2024, we had expected to be a bit of a year or two halves, where, you know, there'd be a lot of home buyers still on the sidelines during the first 6 months of 2024, just because, you know, the expectation was, you know, interest rates are going to remain elevated, and that would still pose a bit of an affordability issue for many of these people. So, you know, definitely the expectation is that, you know, we're going to see a stronger second half of the year with tighter market conditions and more of an acceleration in price growth.
Let's go over to Karen Yolevsky with Royal LePage. Karen, what are you seeing in terms of clientele? Who is selling and who is buying?
Well, we have seen a return of both buyers and sellers to the market, a bit of a ramp up, as Jason alluded to, as we moved through the first quarter and we look towards what's going to happen for the remainder of the year. So people are coming off the sidelines. Prices are rising again. So that's giving sellers some more confidence that it may be a good time to sell. And also, if they're looking to move up or move down and they're going to be buying another home, that their timing might be good now, because as prices start to accelerate, that next home is also going to see a higher price. Buyers, it's a bit of a split camp right now. You've got buyers that are seeing that prices are starting to rise, that more inventory is coming on the market, and they are getting back into the market had they taken a pause last year. However, we do know a number of buyers, particularly first-time buyers, are still on the sidelines waiting to see lower interest rates before they make a move. Some of that is based on affordability and their ability to qualify for a mortgage at current rates.
Right.
And some of that is simply a wait and see to understand where the market's going to go before they make that move.
Karen, in terms of the clientele, first-time buyers, as you mentioned, how young, how old are they in general? Do you have any clients in their 20s, mostly 30s and 40s? Who can afford these $1.12 million homes?
We do have clients in their 20s. We have clients that are first-time buyers at all ages. A number of first-time buyers, though, we do know, are receiving financial assistance
right.
in the form of down payment, also sometimes in the form of even the monthly payment from family members. And that number has been rising, particularly when you look at provinces like Ontario and British Columbia, which, not coincidentally, have the highest prices of real estate in the country.
Jason, what are your thoughts on that as a market analyst? And Karen brought up there about the bank of mom and dad, basically. If you're older and you can afford to help out your young adult children, are you seeing a lot of that happening?
We are. I mean, we do polling every year in conjunction with Ipsos. And one of the things we're asking people is, if you're intending on purchasing a home over the next year, A, are you going to be a first-time buyer? And B, you know, what are the sources of your down payment? And what we found is increasingly over the last decade or so, as we've been doing this polling, is that, you know, sources from, you know, family members and friends, that, you know, that share of a down payment, has been increasing, and it makes sense. I mean, I think you're seeing a lot of, you know, parents, for example, who have a lot of equity in their current home, or they have a lot of savings that they built up over time. And they're thinking, you know, I'm going to transfer, that wealth to my children now versus waiting until I pass on at some point in the future.
Right. And certainly we're seeing a trend of people living longer and aging in the homes that they've been in for decades. How prominent is that trend, Jason? And I want to talk to Karen about that as well.
Yeah, well, I think certainly, you know, one of the storylines that's unfolded over the last number of years is this notion of empty bedrooms. And so you have more aged households that are living in a home, the same home, and often that they've been in for decades. And, you know, in all likelihood, it could be too large for them. But the thing is that they want to live in their existing neighborhood. They still want to go to their shops and go for the walks and take advantage of all the amenities that they become used to over time. And there's not a lot of other options, especially when you're thinking about the types of housing that can bridge the gap between, say, traditional single-family homes and a condominium apartment. And so, you know, that gets back to this notion of missing middle housing, where not only do we need to see more housing supply in the aggregate to keep up with population growth and what have you, but we also need to see a greater diversity of home types to allow people to move up and down through the housing continuum over time. And I think that's really where, you know, the housing debate and the supply debate, you know, has been focused over the last little while, you know, up to and including the federal announcement yesterday.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Karen, your thoughts on that?
So we have also done research where we have seen that older generation isn't downsizing to the extent that we thought they would be downsizing. In some cases, we're seeing them upsize even. If you look at recreational property as an example, the boomer generation is the largest consumer of that property type, and those properties are not small condominiums in downtown Toronto. So we've got people that, as Jason mentioned, they want to age in place. They're comfortable in their neighborhoods and their amenities. There's fewer options available for them that would make sense. They've got a lot of equity built up in their home. And to take that equity and to buy a condominium at today's prices may not make financial sense for them. And they are looking in many cases to transfer some or all of that intergenerational wealth to the next generation. So they're not looking at reinvesting in property at that point in their life. They're looking at how do they make sure that they're benefiting that next generation. So for a number of reasons, we are seeing a bit of gridlock when it comes to housing and a generation that perhaps we thought would be selling those properties, not selling them, staying in them much longer, and creating a lot of pressure, particularly on those single family properties that so many people are looking to upsize into.
It is fascinating, isn't it? Because it used to be people would retire at 65, they'd sell their big home where their kids grew up, and they would downsize into a smaller home or a condo. But Jason, empty nesters are quite happy to be hanging out in their big empty nests.
Yeah, 100%. And I totally agree with the previous comments where, they're choosing not to move and perhaps even looking to move into, in some cases, a larger home because, they want to remain in their neighborhood of choice or the type of neighborhood that they've become accustomed to. And unfortunately, in a lot of cases, there's just not the diversity of home types to allow for a change in type within the same neighborhood or similar neighborhood. And it's become a major issue.
Just a minute to go here, so I'll get final thoughts from both of you on where you see the real estate market in the GTA going for the balance of this year and maybe even into next year. And Karen, certainly that is dependent on interest rates.
Interest rates are going to have a major impact on where the market goes. We know that we're currently in a situation where there still isn't adequate supply to meet demand, and that's with a significant amount of demand sitting on the sidelines. So our predictions at Royal LePage are that we will see continued price increases, particularly in areas like the GTA, as we move through the remainder of the year into 25. Most of those price increases will be back-ended in the year when we start to see interest rates go down. So from mid-year onwards, price increases will likely accelerate. Supply will not be able to keep up with demand.
Jason, the last 20 seconds to you.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think, it's going to be a tale of two halves this year. We're starting to see improvement in market conditions and an increase in demand, but I agree, certainly tangible proof that the Bank of Canada is actually starting to cut interest rates will be important. I think on the first time buyer front, that's going to see a lot of renters that, don't want to spend one more dollar on rent given their level, start to think more about purchasing a condominium apartment. And that gets us back to this notion of the intergenerational transfer of wealth.
Thank you both for your time. It was interesting.
Thank you.
Jason Mercer is Chief Market Analyst and Director of the Toronto Regional Real Estate Board, and Karen Yolevsky is Chief Operating Officer at Royal LePage Real Estate Services. Jane for Libby, who is back tomorrow with the Tune Into the Town panel. Right now, the news with Bob Komsic, and then the number ones at one.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.